welcome everyone to Soda Jerker on Songwriting. It's your fearless leaders, Brian and Simon here, and joining us for this episode is a singer, songwriter and guitarist whose brilliant work across two decades with the band Squeeze has firmly cemented his place in history as one of the true greats of British pop music. As we record this, he's about to release his fourth solo album entitled Happy Ending, which is a set of songs every bit as impressive as we've come to expect from an artist of his pedigree. Today we welcome to the show the fantastic Mr. Glenn Tilbrook.
We're like a couple of prize fighters at the moment, Bri, just one knockout after another. We are so pleased to finally have Glenn on the podcast, as no doubt will be the many listeners who've requested him as a guest over the last couple of years. So here you go, guys. Now you can't say we never give you anything. Do you remember your first exposure to Glenn and Squeeze, Bri?
Actually, the first Squeeze song I was ever aware of was Cool for Cats, and that's because a version of it was used on a Milk advert here in the UK back in the early 90s.
I remember, yeah.
But it was some years later, probably around 2003, that a friend of mine in London, appropriately enough, gave me a compilation of their stuff, and I was hooked from there on in and purchased pretty much their entire back catalogue in the space of about a fortnight.
You never do things by halves.
Nope. And not long after that, I discovered Glenn was playing a solo gig at a small venue in Liverpool called The Mask. So I went down and duly had my mind blown, not only by Glenn's showmanship and command of the crowd, but also the power of his voice and his fantastic guitar playing, and just how well those old Squeeze songs held up in such a stripped-down, intimate setting, mm-hmm. You know. And when he walked into the crowd and stood about a foot away from me playing Black Coffee in Bed, that immediately entered my top 10 all-time gig experiences.
Fantastic. He is a truly brilliant performer, a hell of a singer too. His shows are really lively, spontaneous kind of affairs, aren't they? Mm-hmm. There's a nice documentary from a few years back called One for the Road, which followed Glenn on a solo tour of the States.
Yeah.
And in one sequence, he's seen leading his audience from the gig venue to a nearby house of an audience member where he actually does the rest of the show in the living room.
Awesome. I would have charged on the door if it'd been my place.
Such avarice. But before we speak to Mr. Tilbrook, we'd like to take a minute, just sit right there, to give you some background info on the man. He was born in 1957 in London, England, and credits seeing Cliff Richard in Summer Holiday at the cinema at the age of 5, with first piquing his interest in pop stardom. He took up piano at a young age and then added the guitar to his repertoire a few years later.
I think he was about 11 or 12.
And I think he was 15 when, in the summer of 1973, he answered a guitarist wanted ad in a local newsagent's window. The young gentleman who placed said ad went by the name of Chris Difford, and thus began the prolific songwriting partnership that would eventually be hailed in some quarters as the greatest since Lennon and McCartney.
They formed Squeeze in 1974 with, among others, a young boogie-woogie enthusiast by the name of Jules Holland, and released their self-titled debut album in 1978. The album performed well and yielded a chart hit in the shape of the synth-fueled Take Me, I'm Yours. Their second album, Cool for Cats, released the following year, fared even better, yielding two top 10 hits in the title track and the 3-minute kitchen sink drama of Up the Junction. The latter song in particular marked out Difford and Tilbrook as a true songwriting force to be reckoned with. The former's witty lyrics and economic storytelling combining with the latter's gift for melody to devastating effect, as they would on many subsequent occasions.
The band arguably reached their artistic zenith of this first period with the albums Argy Bargy and East Side Story. I mean, across those two albums, you've got Pulling Muscles from the Shell, Another Nail in My Heart, Is That Love, Tempted, Label with Love. And that's not to mention some of the deeper cuts like I Think I'm Go-Go, Vanity Fair, Piccadilly. They really were just on fire at that point.
Incredible.
The writing was top-notch, the performances were so spirited, and Glenn's guitar playing and arranging speak for themselves, I think.
Yeah, and I think Elvis Costello produced East Side Story, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right.
I suppose that would raise the game of any songwriter to have him overseeing things.
Absolutely. 1982's Sweets from a Stranger followed, which bore another timeless classic in Black Coffee in Bed, and several other fine tracks. I love The Elephant Ride from that one.
Yeah, fantastic song.
But fatigue was setting in and the band took a break for a few years. In the interim, Glenn and his partner released the Difford and Tilbrook album in 1984. Squeeze reconvened the following year, proceeding to trouble the charts on a fairly regular basis once again and maintaining a consistent recording and touring schedule for the remainder of the decade and well into the 90s, highlights of which included the hugely underrated albums Frank, Play and Some Fantastic Place.
Upon Squeeze's second and apparently final split in 1999, Glenn embarked on an impressive solo career, releasing his first album, The Incomplete Glenn Tilbrook, in 2001, and touring tirelessly in support of it in the UK, US and Australia. Due to financial constraints, he performed completely solo, just him, his voice and an acoustic guitar, often in very intimate venues indeed, but to very appreciative crowds, as is documented in the One for the Road film we mentioned earlier.
For his second release, 2004's Transatlantic Ping Pong, he augmented his live setup with an impressive new band, The Fluffers, who've remained with him ever since. Indeed, his third outing, 2009's Pandemonium and Shoes, was credited to Glenn Tilbrook and The Fluffers. In amongst all his solo activity, Squeeze reformed with the addition of two Fluffers as a touring concern to the delight of their fans and have remained together ever since, releasing the album Spot the Difference in 2010, which was comprised of faithful re-recordings of some of their best-known songs.
That's quite similar to what Suzanne Vega did recently with her catalogue.
Yeah, lots of artists get involved with re-recordings these days, don't they, so they can get that control of the masters and stuff. Mm-hmm.
And as we record this episode, it seems the band are gearing up to make a brand new album, which I'm sure you'll agree is a reason to rejoice. In the meantime, we've taken the liberty of bottling their past and labelling it with Sodajerka Glenn Tilbrook Episode 55. Or to put it another way, head on over to sodajerka.com, click on the Glenn episode page, and you'll find a link to our Spotify playlist for this episode, comprised of classic Squeeze and Glenn solo cuts galore.
You can keep up to date with our guest's promotional activities and purchase his wares, including some great collections of his original Squeeze demos, at Glenn's official website, glenntilbrook.com, which also links through to his Facebook page, which is well worth a like. As for us, well, we're in a long-term relationship with sodajerka.com, but we have been known to arrange clandestine trysts with both facebook.com/sodajerka and at @sodajerka on Twitter. Contact us and see what happens.
Okay, so now to the main event. Here's our chat with the triple threat that is Glenn Tilbrook.
A nasty business that never enhanced us. The sort of truth they'd have us believe. Coke-sniffing vicars and kiss-and-tell chances. Digging the dirt for us to receive. The cops came knocking round and tap, tap, tap. Well, we're sure it's nothing but some phones were hacked. A rogue reporter went beyond the pale. But he acted alone and he was sent to jail.
Hey Simon. Hey Brian.
Hi Glenn.
You alright?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. We managed to get a sneak preview of the new album, Happy Ending. It sounds fantastic.
Cool.
We love the exotic percussion and those sort of string arrangements. Did you want to change up the textures on this one a little bit?
Yeah, except on one track, it doesn't sound much like what I started out wanting it to be, which is like a Tyrannosaurus Rex album. I started out with the idea it would be just like a single acoustic guitar and bongos, and gives a definite tip of the hat towards Tyrannosaurus Rex. I've done very few songs where I actually riff on other people's songs, but that one is definitely riffed off of Deborah. So that was the early template, but the more I got into the songs, I realised that I wanted to do drums and electric guitars. I wanted the palette to be a bit wider. And I used iPads as well, that's the only thing I used, but that was it.
All right.
Yeah.
We wanted to ask specifically about the writing of Mud Island. I think that's a really complex kind of one. It's got an Eastern sound to it as well.
Yeah. Really weird you should ask about that. The writing of it, I started writing about my own childhood, and then it got mixed up with Danny Baker's childhood because we're working on a series of songs for a TV series, which is based on Danny Baker's autobiography.
All right.
And we're going to do two songs per episode. When I grew up, and reading Danny's book, our worlds were the same. Anyone who's about the same age as 56, 57, that sort of age, would have grown up, if they grew up in a town, in a sort of post-World War II landscape. But to me, it seems weirder the older I get, because, you know, bomb sites that were there from the 40s lasted through the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s in some cases, you know. It was a great place to grow up, a great place to go and play, dangerous. You know, you're not aware of that when you're a kid. It's just exciting. And that whole world of people come around and collect the money for the telly rental and, you know, come around and collect your rent and all that stuff that people still go through, albeit in a different way. It's a very vivid world to me, and it seems like some sort of strange, exotic land. I guess everyone's past is always strange, exotic land.
Beyond the woods, behind the flats, the builder's yard, and I had cats under my hat. That's where I found some nudie mags, which I'd removed from the spot where they were hidden. I hid it, and I hid them in the bottom of a bag. And when I showed them to my mates, we all said, "Look, but I relate to you right now that that is all we ever did. We were too young then, and no for any other things to grow, but there was pleasure in illicit forest kids."
There seems to be a loose theme of using people's names as titles throughout the album as well. You've got Ray, Rupert, Dennis, Kevin, Dave.
Yeah.
What was the thinking behind that?
He's going to have the whole album be after, you know, names of people. But as I got on, you know, I wanted some of the album to be political. Certainly Rupert is. Also, Everybody Sometimes. I've come to political writing late in life, but it's really important to me, at least, express how I feel about things. And there are two things that happened that really sparked that song off, with Everybody Sometimes. First, my son was involved in the demonstration against student cuts a couple of years ago in London and was kettled by the police and kept in the same spot without any drinks, toilet, food for 8 hours. And I wonder how it could have come to that, you know, the politics that led to that decision being made. And also, one of his best friends, never been involved in violence, was charged by the police for disorderly conduct and threatened, prosecuted for 18 months with a threat of jail hanging over his head. The amount of time, effort, and money that took versus the amount of time, effort, and money that's been taken by the government towards the people who brought Britain to its knees through the financial crisis and sitting on subprime mortgages and financial games that seemingly don't have any consequences for people who invented them. That, you know, it's wrong to me, and it's important to put a line in the sand, and my job as a pop star writer is to make those tunes as appealing as possible to sweeten the sometimes acerbic message contained within. That's Everybody Sometimes.
The place is awash with claim and counterclaim. You've done your bit and kept your head. With time this will all be just a memory soon.
Songwriter, you're one of those rare ones that can actually remember the first song that you wrote, aren't you?
Yeah, I can. You know, it was a really complex, detailed, Phil Spector-ish arrangement with loads of chord changes, and I just dreamt it, and I woke up and could play it. And then I made the verse bit up, which is more like an 11-year-old. What I know about myself is that I didn't know this. It took me a long time to realise that what I have is a gift. Because I always loved music. I never had to work at loving it. And I never really had to work at learning how to play it because it was always so fascinating to me. It was all I wanted to do.
It was the piano that you actually started on, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, I started on piano. But my piano playing had suffered a sort of arrested development in that I got to, I think, about 14, you know, is my piano playing age. But that's been enough to see me through songwriting, and I understood how great different bass notes could be with chords. And, you know, without that, I couldn't have written Tempted or a song like that because it's really relies on the bass changing when the chords don't always change.
And who were you listening to in those formative years?
Well, I started out listening to the Monkees, maybe the first band to get their hooks in me.
Right.
So I think they wrote some really good songs themselves. And then that led me to the Beatles. You know, the first Beatles album I bought when it came out was the White Album. And when I think about that now, I was 11. And I love the White Album. And I feel really lucky to have had that record as my introduction to the Beatles. And being an 11-year-old, to listen to all that stuff was like taking some weird, fantastic journey. And I think there's a lovely thing about being a kid into early teens before you become aware of style and fashion and music. You can listen to anything and find beauty in it. And that's a state I always aspire to be in now.
Absolutely. And did you actually transcribe songs by these artists and sort of learn how their songs were put together?
No. I could either play them or I couldn't. I used to buy these things called record songbooks, just had the lyrics of hits of the day. And so I'd play all the songs that I recognised and then make tunes up to the ones that I didn't know. So that really eerily pre-shadowed what I did with Chris Difford, really.
Wow, yeah, the Squeeze model started early there.
Yeah.
And your guitar playing is a hugely important part of your sound as well. Were there specific influences from a guitar perspective?
You know, up until I was 13, I was just interested in chords because chords were how songs were played for me. Then I heard Jimi Hendrix, and that was a big thing for me because she was the first guitarist that I thought, wow, you know. Brilliant, the whole package. And, you know, pretty soon I realised what a great songwriter he was too. And that's, people don't talk about that as much. The one thing you're going to latch onto that habit is his playing. But, you know, his songwriting is so great, so diverse, you know, and so beautiful in many ways.
Yeah, well, when we found out we were going to speak with you, Brian was really delighted because his favourite guitar solo of all time is "You're Playing on Another Nail in My Heart."
Oh, that's really sweet. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Your solos always seem very carefully composed. Would you agree that you're all about contributing to the overall composition when you take a solo?
Yeah.
Rather than just, you know, shredding?
Yeah. You know, I thought, you know, I'm a good guitarist, but I ain't Jimi Hendrix. I know that. But what I can do is use tunes as a guitarist and try and make that part of the song. And, you know, I haven't done that so much recently, but I used to do it a lot and concoct a solo that becomes part of the song. So in a way, it's as much of the tune as the tune itself is, and those solos, I always play them that way because they were designed to be that way. You know, if I improvise like a blues player, and my songs aren't really blues songs.
And is it quite a painstaking process to piece together that perfect guitar break, or are the solos selected from a bunch of different takes?
Yeah, it is, but one of my favourite guitarist, not many people know, is a guy called Amos Garrett, who's an LA session dude. And I learned early on from someone who worked with him that he used to drop in every three notes and say, no, I want to get that note there. And just, you know, on the fly, make it up until he had what was an amazing solo with stuff he'd never played. But the thing about doing it that way, and that's how I did Another Nail in My Heart, is that, you know, you can play it, but at the end of it, I had to learn how to play it. And it becomes this wonderful tune because you've considered every note properly.
Is a very prolific songwriter as well. You've probably written thousands of songs by this point, I think.
Mm.
Is the process any more knowable to you now?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, because whatever you think you know about songwriting, you still don't know when you start the next song. I always try and start out with lyrics, but I still get stuck on lyrics, I get stuck on tunes. I think things aren't good enough, or I think things are better than they are, you know. You never can quite tell unless you feel absolutely certain about something. I think the greatest gift is when there'll be one song every record that you don't have to work out, that just comes to you. That's a gift. And the other 11 will be work followed by a bit of inspiration followed by a bit more work. But, you know, that's a good thing to have that sort of discipline when you write. And it's also true, I think, that songwriting is like a muscle, you know, and you get flabby when you don't do it.
Right. So you have to get that kind of fitness going.
Yeah, when you get it going, then it becomes easier and easier to construct songs, you know. I mean, there are people who are far more disciplined than me that, you know, have songwriting clubs and say, right, okay, this week's word is pickles, and have pickles in the song. And it's an intellectual exercise to make yourself work, and I respect all that, but I don't do it.
Well, the relationship that gave rise to many of your songs is your partnership with Chris Difford, of course. Did you both naturally fall into those separate roles of writing words and music right away when you first met?
Yeah. I mean, when we met, you know, his lyrics were so much better than mine, and my tunes were really probably better than his. So he gave me a lyric one day, and that was it. You know, I put a tune to it, and we both liked it. And really, we didn't look back from then.
Are we right in thinking that you like to sit down and look at his lyrics for the first time when you're ready to write? You don't actually like to let them percolate for a while?
Yeah, absolutely. When you're writing, so much is like instinctive, hopefully. You know, later on thought kicks in, but instinct's always good to go by.
And did you ever have occasion to say to Chris, you know, I've got this great tune, but the words won't quite fit. Can you write new ones or change the meter, or would you not change a syllable?
Well, we never approached it like that because the words always came first, the tune would always fit. It was done for the words, you know, that's how it worked.
It's incredible to us that a song like Cool for Cats, for example, can work so well without designing the words to fit the music.
Well, actually, that was the exception to the rule because that song, we had the backing track and everything, it was to a completely different tune. It was much slower. Chris came back the next day and was like, wow, okay. So he did that, and it was great. It was brilliant.
The Indians send signals from the rocks above the pass. The cowboys take position in the bushes and the grass. The score is with the corporal, she is tied against a tree. She doesn't mind the language, it's the beating she don't need. She lets loose all the horses when the corporal is asleep. And he wakes to find the fire's dead and arrows in his axe. And Davy Crockett rides around and says, it's cool for cats, it's cool for cats.
So when you're writing, when you see the words on the page, will you reach for the guitar first usually, or might a lyric sometimes suggest another instrument?
I mean, whenever I write, I try and be around a keyboard and a guitar. If you can't have both, you can have one or the other. They both work. I flit in between the two.
Right.
When I'm writing.
Because some of your more complex chord sequences seem to suggest that you do write a fair bit on the piano, but we were thinking of songs like Tempted.
Yeah. Attempted took me about a week to write, and it was very, very, very slow going.
That's the kind of song that's a product of a lot of hard work, isn't it?
It was a product of a lot of hard work. But you're right, Pulling Muscles, that was a keyboard song, Another Nail keyboards. Quite a few other Squeeze classics, I guess. Abbot Junction was a guitar song.
I'd imagine Black Coffee in Bed, was that a piano song?
Yes, it was a piano song, yeah. All the ones where the bass goes off.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's certain chords in Black Coffee in Bed, I don't think have been identified yet.
There's still search parties out for them.
There's a stain on my notebook where your coffee cup was. Oh, there's ash in the pages, now I've got myself lost. I was writing to tell you that my feelings tonight are a stain on my notebook that brings your goodbye.
And what is it that makes you choose a particular chord to accompany a lyric? Is it the image that the words evoke?
You know, describing writing is really hard because it's all about a feeling. It's about a feeling you get when something works. when you get that feeling, it's great, and it's just a private moment. It's the moment you have for yourself, and it's one of elation when you realise that you cracked something.
And you often include quite surprising shifts or key changes too. Do you deliberately shoot for those kinds of things, or is that just the natural direction that your ear leads you in?
Quite a lot of the time, you know, it's lucky accidents, you know. Key changes that sound clever would be up a junction, going down a step and then coming up a step, which sounds like it's not up two steps, you know, but that was all complete accident for me. Very happy accident. And Get Your Gun is another key change where I just got the chords wrong, but it sounded right, so I kept it in. She's up all by the moon. She whistles nonsense tunes. She wants drinks for everyone. She's found a cult that she can strum.
For me, the leaps in melodies and songs like Vanity Fair call to mind people like John Lennon. You know, they always had some kind of interesting twist, even in the verse, to just keep you enthralled.
Yeah, that song is equal parts Beatles and Kate Bush, I think.
And I think You See Me is another example of a song like that, you know, with just a fantastic melody.
Yeah, thank you. I love You See Me because it's got so many different chords in it, and they all work over either one or two bass lines, and I use two of them in there. And it sort of sounds very analytical, but it's just about finding something that works. And then once you've worked for it, it sounds natural. It sounds like you stumbled on it, which you have, but only through process of, you know, taking many wrong turns.
It's all in the way your eyes meet mine that tells me. Look no further, because you see me, you see me, you see me, you believe what you see.
Did you ever have any musical training, like lessons in harmony or anything like that?
No, I didn't, no. I went to piano lessons, but you know, it sounds like one of those stories, but it's true. The teacher just wrapped me over the back of the hands and said, you've got to arch your hands, and so I didn't go back. That was it, I was done.
And yet there must be some technical considerations, especially with the squeeze stuff. For example, when you and Chris are singing in octaves, you must have to construct it so that it doesn't go too low for him or too high for you and that sort of thing.
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? But we just did whatever worked. And and really, that was what worked for us, is that we didn't have a plan. We just opened our mouth and that's what came out. I'm not being, you know, so naive about it. That really is what happened. Sunlight on the line, oh, walk me with a shake. I looked around to find her, but she had gone. Goodbye, girl.
Goodbye, girl. Goodbye, girl. I think the song Hourglass was one occasion where you actually wrote together in the same room. Is that right?
Well, Chris came up with a lyric for the verses, and I added the chorus lyric, but really as an idea to give to Chris about how it could be, but we just ended up keeping those words.
You must have been thrilled when you came up with that chorus.
It just felt so great. It felt, you know, I felt like we had a winner there. The hourglass is the one great to say. But why'd you stop? No more turning heads. The crew of
yet there's a song like Up the Junction, which doesn't really have a chorus in the traditional sense. You kind of leave the title to the end of the song in that one.
Yeah. That was really, you know, when Chris did a lyric, Seven Reverses, I think, it's quite dense and wordy, but a great story. You know, my job was to try and be unobtrusive, I think, and put that across. It made me think of Bob Dylan. That's who I was being in my mind when I wrote the tune. And of course, it doesn't sound like Bob Dylan, but the backing track, which didn't have the overdubs, the sort of the tune bits, which came later. Originally, it was just chords at the beginning and the end. So it did sound sort of like the band.
And was there ever a temptation to add a chorus into the song at all?
No, there was a chorus there. I've only been reminded this by Chris, but the chorus was so not needed that I didn't use it. The whole story was there. I didn't need anything else. So just a requirement.
I never thought it would happen with me and the girl from Clapham out on a windy common. That night I ain't forgotten when she dealt out the rations with some or other passions. I said, you are a lady. Perhaps she said, I may be. We moved into a basement with thoughts of our engagement. We stayed in by the telly, although the room was smelly. We spent our time kissing, the railway arms were missing, but love had got us hooked up, and all that time it took up.
And how important is arrangement for you? Are you a believer in the idea that a good tune can sort of stand up in any format, or does the arrangement need to be definitive as well?
I'm a big believer in the fact that you can arrange a song in 20 different ways, and that the way that you write a song isn't necessarily the way that it should be.
Right.
You know, and again, you never know. Tempted is written as a, like, ELO grand orchestral pop song. And we recorded it like that, and it sounded horrible. but, you know, that's how I thought it should be. And then, you know, we'd recorded a mixed version one, and then we thought we hadn't really cracked that after a while. So we did it again, and the version that everyone knows, we arrived at eventually.
Tempted by the fruit of another, tempted, but the truth is discovered. What's been going on now that you have gone? There's no other. Tempted by the fruit of another, tempted, but the truth is discovered.
You've collaborated with some other writers in recent years, people like Ron Sexsmith, Amy Mann, Chris Braid.
Mm.
Do those writers have different approaches to writing with Chris?
Well, with Amy and Ron, this is when I was feeling particularly vulnerable lyrically. You know, I needed someone who could write lyrics. And I was writing some, but I wasn't confident, so I needed some ballast. And they really did that job great for me. Nowadays, for me, like on Happy Ending, I've written all the lyrics, and it's a really important part of what I do, having that space and freedom to do that. I love it. I absolutely love it. I still like doing tunes, but I'm happier giving tunes to people. I get a lot of different stuff coming back at me, and it's great to interpret all that as a musician.
Someone like Ron Sexsmith is great with the melody as well, so
yeah.
Does it take some discipline for you to kind of hold back when you write with someone like that?
No, because when I've worked with Ron, all he's ever done is give me words and just let me do the tune bit. So, you know, You See Me is a lovely song I wrote with Ron. There's another one we wrote called By the Light of the Cash Machine, which I didn't have on my first album. I don't know why now, because it's one of my favourite songs.
That's on the One for the Road documentary, I think, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is, yes. Yeah. You know, and that's just, it's such a great Ron lyric, you know. A romantic soul, instead of By the Light of the Silvery Moon, it's By the Light of the Cash Machine. It's just great.
With you, everything is wonderful and new. I feel as though I've never been used. Do you know what I mean? So I kiss you.
Some of the early Squeeze tracks, I'm thinking Take Me, I'm Yours, Slap and Tickle and The Knack, they make use of sort of electronic elements like Moog synths and drum machines.
Yeah.
Was that technology used at the writing stage for those songs, or was that more of a production choice?
No, you know, we're absolutely mad about all that stuff. You know, I bought a Mini Moog with my first royalty check and I was off. Like many other people, I love Kraftwerk. I've been into them since before we started making records. So that had always been on my horizon. And I love playing with the Mellotron, which we managed to get. At that time of Squeeze, there were still some of the old Mellotrons knocking around. There were 12-year-old tapes in them as they were there. It was just brilliant.
Is technology part of your writing process these days, or do you tend to stick to the acoustic instruments?
I never like to rule anything out, which is why I love working with iPads, because there's some really great apps, you know. So if I get myself into one way of working, next time around I like to change the way I work, where I'm writing or what I'm writing with or how I do it, because the important thing is to always try and surprise yourself and not believe that you've got it cracked.
Well, we know you're not averse to writing a song in the back of a transit van if you need to.
It's been done before and it will be done again.
We've heard you say that some songs come more quickly than others.
Yeah.
Were any of the songs from the new album ones that just flowed out and didn't take much labour?
I wouldn't call it a song. It's more of an experience. The last track on the record's called Ice Cream.
Right, yeah.
And I knew that I wanted to do something like this. And so I thought of Ice Cream the night that I was recording and working on something else. And a friend of mine was having a birthday party around the corner in the pub, local to the studio, the Anchor and Hope. And so I went and got everyone out there at closing time and got them back to the studio and just asked them to sing this tune with the words. So I didn't write that, it just wrote itself. But it's not a proper song, you know, it's an experience.
As you're writing and you're documenting your ideas, do you find that you're saving up little fragments here and there and then incorporating them into new songs later on?
Totally, yeah. Right now, these are the, you know, happy endings, the amount of songs I managed to bring in. And some of those were from stuff that I've been working on for some time. And some of the stuff that I've been working on for this record won't make it for the next one. Two songs I think are going to be great that I didn't manage to pull in properly in time. Sometimes you just have to let it lie for a bit and come back to it.
There's a couple of other songs we wanted to mention before we finish. Interviewing Randy Newman is the first.
Mm.
It's a fascinating story song, that one, and really captures what it's like to be doing this sort of thing, which of course we're doing right now. Can you talk a bit about that one?
Yeah, that whole song is about losing your nerves or finding out as it happened. I've been wildly overconfident about my ability to grasp questions out of the air. Are you showing up on questions? No, I'll be fine. We'll just chat. It'll be great, you know. And so we booked the studio and had the down-the-line experience. And 10 seconds before we got connected, I thought, oh, fuck. What am I going to say? And it was a real panic. You know, it was quite a desperate-sounding interview. And then I've asked the questions I should have. We had to go back and repair it. And you know, it would be like me going and trying to make up a song on stage or something. It was just about as terrifying as that. I'm not good at that. It's not my area. And it was a horrible little wake-up call for me. The only redeeming factor of it was the song was the first one I wrote lyrically that I felt opened the door for me to write more, that I could be pleased enough with that.
Well, we'll be sure to write one about you after this.
He looked a little bit nervous. I said that it would be
great. We're taping here in London and Randy's at home in LA. Cut to 2 hours later, and it's 1 minute to five. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm glad this isn't going out live. There's a pounding in my heart as I start interviewing Randy Newman.
The other song we wanted to mention is Some Fantastic Place, which I think is one of your favourites and one of ours too.
Yeah.
It's a very emotional song, but we love that you and Chris took such a positive approach to it musically and lyrically.
Yeah.
Have you got any memories of how that one came together?
Yeah, it's one of those songs that Chris gave me in lyrics. It was about really my first girlfriend, Maxine, her name was. And the tune, really, I sat at the piano and played the song. The song just happened. I didn't even stop. It just happened. And that was it. It's a weird experience because it was a complex song to just happen. And then when we recorded it, I added another bit from a really early Squeeze song. When Chris and I had first met, and one of the earliest songs we'd written, we were very pleased with it at the time. So that became the basis for the solo. We tacked that all together. And it made for an emotional song, you know, and very proud of it.
It has an almost gospel feel to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's what we're after. My Sweet Lord, Oh Happy Day. Some Fantastic Place, hopefully all in the same breath.
I have the hope that when it's time for me to come away, that she'll be there to show me around whenever comes that day. Her love was life and happiness, and in her steps I trace to live a better life than some fantastic place, some fantastic place, some fantastic place.
We're very excited to hear there's a brand new Squeeze album in the pipeline, isn't there?
Yeah, it's gonna be great. I think it's gonna be really good. If it's not, we're not releasing it.
So there's no more details for two salivating geeks like us?
Well, just that it's gonna be, you know, based on the Danny Baker book, it's gonna be part of a TV series. So this is our new model, is that ITV is paying for us to make two Squeeze albums, one per year.
Wow.
For the next 2 years.
Fantastic.
We get two songs per episode, and we're free agents, you know, we just have to be in the same ballpark. But they're not character-driven songs. They're not going to be people bursting into songs halfway through an episode. It's going to be more reflective and slightly more, not detached, but in a parallel world to the way the stories are going within the scripts. So that gives us a purpose, because we know that it's going to be heard, and also it's a budget. Like in the old-fashioned world, where you'd have a record company fronting your money. So, you know, on this record, we can afford to go orchestral if we want. And I do want, you know, I want to do that. Now I want to go massive again.
That sounds fantastic. Well, we'll certainly be looking forward to that.
Cool. Excellent. Well, meet you same time next year then.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks so much for chatting with us. I mean, we're great admirers of yours, so it's a real bucket list moment for us.
Oh, that's really great. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Cheers, Glenn.
Cheers, Glenn.
All right, cheers. Cheers, loves. Bye.
Take care. See you now. Bye-bye.
But behind the chalet, my holiday's complete. And I feel like, will you tell? Make Mary around her tiptoe feet. Pulling muscles from a shell. Pulling muscles from a shell.
That was Glenn Tilbrook talking to us on the Soda Jerker podcast from his tour bus, I believe.
He was en route to one of many dates on his current UK tour.
Great to get some insight from him on his songwriting process, talk about Squeeze, writing with Chris Difford. I mean, he's one of our heroes, what can we say?
Yeah, it was just fantastic. We hope you've enjoyed this as much as we have. So without further ado, I think we're going to change the mood a little and go posing down the pub.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.
If you'd like to listen to some of the songs referenced in our podcasts, visit our website at sodajerker.com, and on each episode page, you'll be able to find a link to Spotify where you can listen to a playlist of some of the biggest hits of the artists that we've been talking to.
Don't forget, if you'd like to get in touch, you can visit our website at sodajerker.com, or you can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/sodajerker. Alternatively, you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/sodajerker. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Just search for Soda Jerker on Songwriting and remember to leave a comment. Until next time,
his phone is dead.